Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It really is, in a way, a Blue Monday. I mean, I'm not depressed, don't get me wrong, but it's a Blue Monday. When I saw that that horse die on the track, really being executed on a track, something in me, at the one hand, cried out. Another hand, I wanted to kill somebody on the track. There's something wrong with a sport where when the performer ceases to perform, it's executed. That'd be like a talk radio host who loses his voice and they euthanize him. That'd be the equivalent of a boxer who breaks his wrist and they have to euthanize him in the ring. Or can you imagine a baseball player who breaks two legs and they have to euthanize him on a ball field? It's unheard of. It's barbaric. Should the jockey be arrested for animal cruelty? You know, they don't use whips in Europe. Are you aware that the jockeys are not permitted to use whips in Europe because it's considered animal cruelty? I am sick and tired of listening to this rubbish that the jockey didn't know, he couldn't know, he didn't blah, blah, blah. Hey, a jockey is supposed to know what the horse is doing. How could this jockey not have known the horse broke his legs and whips this filly on? Whips the filly on while she has broken legs? I felt like saying they should whip him on with broken legs. But anyway, that was one story, and I could ask you, something's wrong about this picture, and it's really heartbreaking. I went to the De La Hoya fight. Thank God no one broke their legs there. I left after a few rounds because I felt as though I was going to get stampeded in there. It was a very interesting situation in that stadium down in L.A., and I got a new view of the world in a way. Yeah, I got to admit to you, in some ways, as worldly as I think I am, I think there's a part of me that's rather naive in some ways. Just as all of us, and none of us have perfect knowledge. You got to come to Los Angeles and be here for a while to see the future of America. It's not all apocalypto in East L.A. where police are afraid to roll. We know about that part of L.A. I was in the third row at the fight. In front of me was an Hispanic man about 40 years old, suit and tie with two young guys. They were 8 and 10 years old, his sons or I don't know who. And these kids were like great, perfect guys. And I said, you know what? That's the future of America. The future is not the gangbanger, because this guy in front of me, who looked like Villagrosa or someone like him, and talking style-wise, this guy understands the dangers to this city and to this country, and he'll be more likely to build jails faster than John McCain would. That's what I thought to myself. And speaking of John McCain, you talk about a campaign going off the rails. It couldn't get any worse than John McCain's campaign. I wake up today, and it says he's going to appeal to, again now, Hispanics. John McCain is now putting up a Spanish website to appeal to Hispanics, an important constituency for his election. I said, yeah, but not conservatives. Everyone is invited into John McCain's little tiny tent except conservatives. The man can't win. I'm telling you right now, unless he stops listening to the drunkard who's running his campaign, he's toast. And Hillary's the next president, which would be a disaster for America. John McCain cannot win unless the base that put all these freaks in power in the first place, the conservative base, is motivated to come out and vote. And they're not going to come out and vote if this idiot continues to say we've written you off. That's my opinion. Now I want to tell you about something else here on a Monday, because I start my shows with an awful lot of ammunition to give you something to bite on. Listen, you are listening to the Savage Nation. And the phone number is 1-800-449-8255. 1-800-449-8255. We have some interesting questions to talk about. I want to tell you a story, and I want to tell you of a premonition. I'm calling this segment Escape from a Death Train. Now, first, I'm going to tell you what I dreamed last night, and then I'm going to tell you the reality of what happened today. Here's what I dreamed last night. I dreamed I was being chased by someone. I had no weapon. The person was very bad and evil, and I kept going higher up in a house, and there was no way out except through a window. And I calculated that I had to jump out of the top floor window, but if I didn't, I knew I was dead. So I jumped out of the window, landed in bushes, and escaped. And this was like a repetitive dream of me jumping out of a window, escaping a very bad guy who just missed me at the last second. Now, let's speed the clock forward. Monday afternoon, Michael Savage is having lunch with some young people in their 20s. See, when I come to L.A., I see young people. In San Francisco, it's a bunch of old, broken hippies and illegal aliens and other constituencies that I'm not too fond of. So I come down here, it's another world. L.A. happens to have a huge young population of young, dynamic, optimistic people. By the way, it's a great city. So I'm at lunch with two young people. We're eating sandwiches from a deli. One word leads to another, I don't know how. And one of the guys says to me his grandmother was on a death train when she was 16 years old with her brother in Poland a long time ago. The brother's 14, the brother dies on the death train. She's 16. The brother's dead in her arms. She knows she's going to die. She climbs up to the little cracked window on the top of this death train, the cattle car, and she leaps out of the window, falls in the snow. The German guard on top of the train shoots her, hits her in the shoulder and the leg. They see blood on the snow, and they leave her there for dead. Polish farmers, good Christians, rescue the woman who happens to be Jewish. They nurse her back to health. She says, I'm going to get out of here now because you're going to wind up getting in trouble if I stay here. She finds her way into the Warsaw ghetto. She becomes an underground resistance fighter, a sniper against the Nazis, survives the war, comes to America now, and lives to start a family. She died a few years ago in her 70s. I said, holy God, I said, what an inspirational story this is. I said, people don't know how real these things are. They think it's just a storybook. I said, this is better than a movie. But they don't make movies about this. They make movies about, whatever. What do you need fiction for when reality is so much better, I said to myself. So I call that escape from a death train. But don't you think it's amazing that I would have this dream about me jumping out of a window to escape, that I meet this young guy, and he tells me, this was casual out of nowhere. Grandmother is escaping a death train on the way to Auschwitz. Brother dies in arms, leaps out of a window. German guard shoots her. A shoulder, leg, left for dead. Train keeps moving. Blood on snow. A Christian Polish couple rescues her, nurses her back to health. She leaves them because she doesn't want to get them in trouble. She has nowhere to go but into the ghetto where she knows there's a resistance group. It's the only place left. She lives through the whole war as a sniper. Survives, emigrates to America, and here he is, the grandson, sitting here in Beverly Hills, California. I said, oh my God, what a sweep of history. I said, this is better than Dr. Zhivago. This is better than Dr. Zhivago. And you know something? It reminds me of an adage I read years ago. It was a title of a book. It was called Life is with People. For me, it's more true than anyone else that I know. I live as a result of my interactions with people. And it's people that will sustain us. It is people that will depress us. It is people that will lift us up. It is people who will put us down. This is the Savage Nation. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. We can talk about McCain and Hispanics and why he disrespects conservatives and whether or not he can win without us. We can talk about they shoot jockeys, don't they? We can talk about survival in the snow on a death train. All this and more right here on the Savage Nation when I return. Be here. Savage. Opening up the second segment here of the Savage Nation. First is the horse story. Should jockey and trainers be arrested for animal cruelty? We are also talking about escape from a death train here on the Savage Nation. both with my premonition and the reality of today. Remember, you know, this show really is about survival today. And I would say that each of us listening to this show is a story of survival. If you think, I told you the story about this young man sitting here, and it turns out the grandmother escaped the death train and how she did it. He wouldn't be here had she not done that, right? Have you ever thought about all of the permutations and combinations of your past? How could we all know what switch tracks in our ancestors' pasts led to you being born and you surviving? Just look at your own life. How many things have you done that almost ended your life? How many things have you done that put you on the path of life? I mean, it's an astonishing thing, and it really brings you back to a belief in spirituality and a belief in God. That's all I can say. Nothing else can do it other than thinking about survival. I know it saved me. When all else failed, when I focused on one thing, it clarified my whole life, and that was think about survival. Everything will fall in place. Everything else fell in place because I asked God for one thing. I asked God to help me survive economically. And believe me, he helped me survive economically. That's how it works. There was no winning. I didn't win a lottery. I came with a little penalty. You see, God gives you a fishing rod, not a fish. And he says, you want to eat? Here's the fishing rod. It'll work as long as you want to. But when the day you don't want to fish, you're not going to catch any fish. So what I'm saying to you is, you can pray for help from God for your survival. You'll get a fishing rod. You're not going to get a fish. Now let's go back to the horse. It's a big story. A lot of people say it's animal cruelty. A lot of people say, no, there was no choice. It broke very fine bones. I know the whole story. The fine bones, the blood capillaries. You know what I think it was? The big I word, insurance, San Diego. Andy, welcome to the Savage Nation. What do you think?
Dr. Savage, first time caller. And I just want to say that as soon as I heard on Fox CNN, the owner, saying, you know, boo-hoo, crying, you know, this is like family. First thing I thought about was insurance. These horses are insured for millions of dollars. Why couldn't he put it out to pasture, you know, and
well, here's their argument. I have their whole argument in front of me, which is that the breaks in the legs. Okay, race horses have finer bones than any other breed, okay? And there's there are numerous capillaries and blood vessels that are in the lower leg. When a horse breaks a bone down there, the bone shatters, cutting up the blood vessels to the point where they say they cannot be repaired. And the bones are so fine that the break will be mended weekly or will continually rupture. I will tell you this. My feeling is that the reason they euthanize the horse is because the insurance policies say you get full coverage, full payment if the horse is euthanized, because the injury is too severe for the horse to be cared for, right? I don't think anybody in the world would write an insurance policy where we're going to provide ambulatory care for an animal for the rest of its natural life. You follow me? So it's all or nothing. They killed it for the insurance, in my opinion. I agree with you.
Absolutely.
I agree with you. That's how I see it. Always follow the money and don't look at the crocodile tears. That's all. Rachel, WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to tell you that for years, I hear you on the radio, and I'm petrified to talk to you. Because you sound like you're going to eat me up through the phone. And I said, today I matured and I could talk to you. So here's what I want to say. That
Please.
Story about the train and... I'm so nervous. Okay. About the train and what you had the dream about jumping out of the stairs. I just want to tell you, if you would realize how much you need God in your life. Michael, I'm telling you I'm 38 years old. I'm a little nothing compared to you. But I wake up every morning and I see God taking my hand and leading me through life. And every time I hear you, I want to cry. I'm thinking, this Michael, he doesn't know. He says he's went through all these different things that he tried, and it's staring at him in the face. And he was born into that nationality, and he's avoiding it. He doesn't want to face it. And once you face it, once you let go of that fear, you have such a fear. Once you let go of that fear, you're going to be the happiest person in the world. I'm telling you, when I go home every day and I hear you talk, you have such a life. God gave you 3 hours a day to convince people and be such an influence. And you're doing such an amazing job. And
wait a minute. So you're answering your own question in a way. What you're saying is you're doing God's work, and what needs to be done next? If I'm doing God's work, What more needs to be done?
Because you're not sure. You're not sure. You're looking for something. You're not sure what it is. I hear it.
Well, but I think the human condition is one of searching and doubting. In fact, if you search the history of any religion, you'll find people doubted their own religion. Mother Teresa, you know who she is, yes?
Yes, I know.
All right. Maybe she's not from your tradition. I'm sure she isn't. When her diaries were published after her death about a year ago, people were shocked to find out she doubted God's existence. But she continued to do God's work as though God existed. But she doubted till her death whether or not there was really a God. So doubting does not mean that there is no God, and doubting doesn't mean that you're not a good person.
No, but there's got to be a point in your life when you make a decision. You know, you're not, you know, you can't wake up.
Well, listen, I'm not here to make you a doubtful person. I am glad you have found your truth, and I appreciate that. I'm going to leave it go with that. I don't want to debate it, you know. I don't want to debate that. This is a topic I can't debate. 1-800-449. See, God just disconnected me from the server because the woman called and gave me a chance, and now I'm disconnected from the callers. We're talking about horses. We're talking about survival from a death train. We're talking about each of us is a story about survival. And there'll be other stories. And John McCain. I think John McCain is running the worst race I've ever seen. He keeps appealing to every demographic except the one that put him in business. Remember, John McCain was elected in Arizona. What's Arizona? Was a conservative state. Who basically built the conservative seat that John McCain is sitting in? Who was it? I'll give you a quote and you'll know who it was, okay? You ready? Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. Barry Goldwater. I don't know who wrote that. That is probably the single greatest political line I can remember. There are some other good ones. JFK's great line, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. That was great. That motivated me when I was a young man. None of the current crop of candidates motivates me in any way. They're hacks. They're in it only for their own self-aggrandizement, and they're party people, period. We need leaders. We need someone to look up to. We need a general to lead us through this life of ours. We know the dangers out there. The economic dangers around us are phenomenal, and I'll tell you more about what I learned. Jeremiah Savage here, crying out in the wilderness. Welcome back to the program. Phone number 1-800-449-8255. I am like Jeremiah, crying in the wilderness here. I mean, I know you hear me. I know my listeners hear me. But I'll tell you, the politicians are absolutely tone deaf. And it's frightening. You got Hillary running to the right. You got McCain running to the left. And they think that they can fool all of the people all of the time. Amazing to me. You know, God sees the truth but waits. That's all I can say. And each of us has a spark of God within. We all see the truth. Eureka, California. Lance, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Michael, thank you so much. The reason I listen to you is to get some tears pulled every now and again from stories like The Death Train. It's fantastically well done. It's such a beautiful story.
It's amazing. Isn't it inspiring in a way?
Well, it's what the world is made of, and... what can I say? I tell you the story of my father and the B-26s?
Please.
12 of them. And the order is hold formation against one German jet equipped with a Krupp 88 cannon. And
Wait, you're talking about the late in the war when they introduced the first Messerschmitt, the jet Messerschmitt?
Very late. Possibly Hitler was already dead. It was a Messerschmitt 262, and it had a Krupp 88 cannon through the nose. It might have been Adolf Galland. I don't know.
All right, so she's a shark cutting up the B-29. B-24s, did you say?
B-26, Martin Marauder B-26.
The Martin Marauder, and she was cutting them up.
Exactly. There were six of them that went down in about 90 seconds. Just one.
Oh my God.
Messerschmitt 262. And through that phalanx, that incredible thing, somehow my father made it, just like the death train.
I hear you. So you're thinking like you wouldn't, you're saying you wouldn't be here either, but for that miracle of survival.
Quite right.
Was he the only survivor?
No, there were six other aircraft. Each aircraft was, I think, six individuals. So So 12 aircraft, 72 men, and I think half of them went away that day.
Well, how many planes came back?
I think it was six. My father told me this when he was dying of cancer. He had kept
hidden
the whole time. So,
well, he didn't tell you the story till he was very old, you mean?
Right. He was almost 72 before he told me this. Maybe he didn't want to shock me. I don't know. It's quite a serious thing. Of course, there are thousands of stories just like this. Probably.
Well, okay. So when I make this story, when I tell you the story of each of us is a story about survival, have you thought about the permutations and combinations of your own life or of those in your past, what it took for them to get you here now, and the miracle of every breath you take, that's what touched you.
Well, exactly. It's the pure chance that brings this particular strand of DNA to the third millennium after Christ. What can I say?
Hey, what can you say? You said it pretty good. But, you know, we can't walk around every minute that we take every breath and every bite of food and say, I am a miracle, can we?
Well, you have to rejoin reality each step forward. But the past is undeniable and stunning.
Yes, I'll let you go with that. I hear you, and I thank you for calling. Phone number 1-800-449-8255. Unfortunately, right now I'm disconnected from my caller base. I cannot take calls at this time. For some reason, the remote computer did not respond, and I'll have to wait for a break to fix that. So, can you guys put a caller up on the show without the connection? Yes or no? Do it if you can. If not, I will do what is known in the business as fly-by-wire. However, you'll have to tell me whether you can in some way. And line three is ready. Line three, go ahead, please.
Michael.
Yes.
Dovetailing on your survival story, my father was a platoon sergeant in World War II. And as an older gent, underwent quadruple bypass surgery and had to give up smoking, something he had picked up in the Army. So I asked him one day how he was doing with you know, the cigarette habit, and he says, let me tell you the story a cigarette saved my life. And he was basically dug in on a beach with his platoon and others, and he says there was incoming German artillery. And he says, frankly, he says, you never know when on the other side of the incoming artillery the infantry may be marching right behind it. He says, well, the artillery barrage stopped. He says, we had a few moments. I'm sitting there in my foxhole deciding I need a cigarette. So I called over to a buddy, he says, who was in a neighboring foxhole. Can I bum a butt? He says, the buddy said, sure, come on over. And he says, I left my foxhole with my rifle in it. Now, he says, bear in mind, he says, I'm a platoon sergeant. If any of my men had done that, I would have kicked their butt from one end of the beach to the other.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, I knew better. So I ran over. I bummed the cigarette. He says, while I'm in there in his foxhole, more incoming. So he says, I'm smoking this cigarette and filling my drawers at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
He says, as soon as that barrage is over, I run back over to my foxhole and I discover my rifle in splinters. He says, that's the day a cigarette saved my life. And I said, Dad, that's the day a cigarette saved my life.
Well, great story. Was anyone in that original foxhole with him?
No. It was
empty. He was there.
With his rifle.
So, but why did he leave his gun there? That's very unusual.
It is very unusual, and that was his remark, too. He says, as a platoon sergeant, if I had seen any of my men do that, I would have kicked their butt from one end to the other. And I think it was just, a momentary lapse.
So what do you take away from that miracle?
Well, I'll tell you, as a chaplain in a hospital now, a major hospital in the Albany area, as well as, over 30 years in ministry, life is frail, absolutely frail, and it's never to be taken for granted. And even as I say that, I know that sometimes we have to kind of take things for granted just to move through the stuff of life and do the things that we need to do. But in our better moments, it's really appropriate for us to just step back from this and say, thank you, God, for love and life. Once we've said that, we've said everything.
No, there's almost no words for what we're talking about. It's almost an indefinable topic. This is now bordering on theology, what we're talking about. Only prayer can answer these questions, and only prayer can describe what we're talking about. I told a story, Escape from a Death Train, that was so vivid, so real, so based in reality that anybody could grasp it. It doesn't matter how old they are. They could understand that miracle. But beyond that, you have to start talking about theology to understand the story. I mean, you could say, did that woman on that train, what made her jump out of the window? What made her, a woman 16 years old, where did she have the guts to jump out of a window train, while everyone else was screaming and crying? They knew they were going to go to their death and did nothing. They were so frightened. Wouldn't most of us be so frightened, stripped of our dignity and debased as humans? We wouldn't know what to do. We'd be sitting like cowering animals. Here's a girl, 16, whose brother's dead in her arms. She has the wherewithal to jump out of a window of a death train, then gets shot by the German and is left to bleeding in the snow, and a Christian family in Poland saves her. Then she goes into the Polish underground and becomes a sniper. This is a story, a movie right here. Do you think Hollywood would ever make this movie? Terry, in this day and age, do you think these guys would ever make such a movie?
Be too gutless.
Right. They would wonder if it would sell in the Arab world.
That's right.
They would wonder if it would sell in the Holocaust denier communities. You know what I'm saying? They'd run it up the flagpole in Holocaust denier communities. It wouldn't sell in Syria and Iran. You know what I'm saying? There goes two foreign markets for the DVDs.
It's a story that has real morality.
I don't know what it has in it. But in light of the dream I had last night of jumping out of a window to escape a guy who was pursuing me, was amazing to me. Anyway, it has nothing to do with me. Or does it? I don't even know. Was it a premonition of what this story, well, he was going to tell me a story? I don't really know anymore. I don't know, but thank you. And then that was a great caller. The dad in the foxhole, you heard it here on the Savage Nation. Now, due to celestial events, I am reconnected to my caller base. You want to hear about a miracle? Radio is a miracle. You're listening to a man sitting thousands of miles away from you, probably. And through the miracle of telecommunications, you're able to hear my voice. I'm sitting alone in a studio in the middle of Area 29 here. And I don't know, it's a miracle, the whole thing, how I got into radio, how I stay in radio, and how I'm able to reach so many people. And I know it's a gift. Trust me, I know this is a gift. You know, last night I was reading the history of the Romanovs in Russia. I know, it's like, oh, how exciting. It was exciting. Because there are a lot of things that I learned about what the Romanovs did in Russia before the Communist Revolution that scared me. The autocratic system of the Romanov dynasty in Russia, the Tsars, the royal family, how they were living compared to the ordinary person. There are some parallels between them and the power structure in America today, and it really worried me. It worried me greatly when I saw that as a result of the war, Russia had such a runaway inflation, and they had food shortages. This led to mass unrest. Of course, that gave the communists, who are in our equivalent here, we have outright communists, but we have many silent communists in this country, and they're all found in the Democrat Party, although I think there's quite a few of them in the Republican Party as well, only they don't know it, because they're acting just like the Bolsheviks did. But the parallels were amazing. First, the Tsars took all of the ethnic minorities, whether they be Catholics or Jews, or any of the other minority religions in Russia, and they crushed them and made them forget their indigenous languages. They wouldn't let them teach their indigenous languages. They closed down all of the minority schools, and they tried to homogenize all of them with a massive state education. Aha, I say, well, that was good. No, but it was a low-grade education that was meant to keep them rather stupid and also to keep them rather imprisoned. And I said, oh, my God, that sounds so much like our state-run school system here in the United States of America. And I'll tell you more about that at another time, because I had an amazing conversation today with one of the most, let us say, I don't know how to put it, a very prominent man. And one of his passions is education and reforming education in America. And he told me over and over again today, just this morning, that state schools are fundamentally functioning on the order of a Stalinist totalitarian system where there is no competition. He said the state schools, the public schools, are a monopoly. He said all monopolies are terrible. All monopolies produce very poor results. He said if there is a monopoly in business, it produces a poor result. He said if there's a monopoly in education, it produces a very poor result. So this was connected to the book I was reading last night on the Romanovs. And that's why I was saying it's been an amazing series of synchronous events here. It always is whenever I come down here for some reason. But let's go back to the bread and butter issue of the day, which is the jockey and the horse. I'm serious. So play the starting trumpet for a minute. Starting. All right, so the horse breaks its legs while running. They euthanize it on the track. My guts are ripped out. All right, so I'm a city slicker. I don't understand. I don't know, maybe I do understand. Maybe there is something in me that does understand. Now, the Europeans do not permit whipping a horse. That's number one. Number two, I rarely agree with PETA. I think they're a bunch of extremist nuts who don't know what they're doing, and they're doing it mainly for grandstanding. But actually, what they're asking for, I agree with. One, no racing or training for a thoroughbred until it turns 3 years old. I don't know about that. They say the animal's legs aren't fully developed until then. Two, no more racing on dirt tracks. The group says the synthetic surfaces now used at Keeneland in Lexington, Kentucky, and at California tracks are far safer and result in fewer equine breakdowns and fatalities. Three, cap the number of times a horse races each year. Four, ban whipping. PETA says that when jockeys flail horses with a riding crop, the animals can be forced beyond their physical limits. I'm an open-minded man. I don't care what the name of the organization is. I could have disagreed with them 5,000 times before today. I happen to agree with them. I told you, politics makes strange bedfellows. When I try to stop the Dubai ports deal, which I succeeded in doing because of this audience, I had Chuck Schumer on the show. I never agreed with anything Chuck Schumer had done before, nor since. But when I agreed with him, I reached out to him. And he was a big enough man to reach back to me, which is more than I could say for the Republican Party. This is the Savage Nation. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. We're talking about survival. We're talking about the horse being euthanized on the racetrack in Kentucky. We are talking about our personal survival and what brought us to this moment that we can even be listening to this show. Maybe you're just scanning a dial and hitting the station. You don't even know who I am. I'm talking about you. Greg, Cincinnati, Ohio, was at the Kentucky Derby. Greg, tell us what you think.
Michael, God bless you. I am finally glad someone is speaking the truth. I was along turn two, and when I seen this horse went down, I've been to Keeneland. I do the Bluegrass Stakes. I do the Derby almost yearly. Very rarely do I ever miss a Derby. They put that horse down so quick because it was so painfully obvious it was an insurance purpose.
They Bingo.
Did not think a horse could survive, and it was disgusting to me. It's truly a black eye on the Kentucky Derby.
The minute I saw that, my heart broke, number one, and I said they should euthanize whoever did that. They're criminals. And yeah, I see the stuff they put out about the thin bones and the blood vessels, and I'm trained in anatomy. I understand what they're saying, but it doesn't make sense to me that they'd cap the horse right on the track like it's a piece of dirt.
It was disgusting. I can sing all three verses of My Old Kentucky Home, and I'm ashamed I can sing it.
Greg, my feeling is the minute I saw it, I can add up pretty quickly, insurance, insurance, insurance. In other words, those policies are written which say if the horse is injured beyond any care and has to be euthanized, you collect the full $9 or $20 million. If, on the other hand, the horse is injured and can be rehabilitated, you collect zero. Isn't that basically what you think, too?
You are correct, sir. I've seen that horse went down. I've seen the EMS come out, and I knew exactly what they're getting ready to do, and it disgusted me. I left shortly thereafter.
Well, I tell you the truth. I'm pretty quick read. I can figure things out quickly. Thank you for the call. Not everyone's going to agree with me, but some do and some don't. It's strange. I'm not a sportsman. I'm not really into sports, but, you know, I do watch this and that. I go to the fights because the family's involved in supporting and advertising extreme fights and now major league fights like the De La Hoya fight. I mean, I got to tell you, it's a proud moment for me to sit there and see my son's product up there. Like, you know, when I was a kid, I told you, I can't believe this. And it's so awesome sometimes you can't even believe what you're looking at. Incidentally, Sylvester Stallone was like, we were in, you know, one ring around the one corner of the ring, and Sylvester was there on the other side. And somehow caught the eye. Someone went over. He came over to me. He's a very nice guy. And we took a picture together. And I was very amazed that he would get up to come to see me. I mean, I'm only a radio guy, and he's probably one of the most recognizable personalities in the world. You got to say, face-wise, Sylvester Stallone has to be one of the top five in the world in terms of recognizable personas. He's a great guy. I mean, for the few minutes that I met him, I really couldn't believe that he would just come over. But anyway, that was a side note. Ron, KNEW, San Francisco. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Michael, it's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I wanted
to get your take on that fight because I think you said it was your first pro fight or...
No. I went to several before. We once were involved with the Mosley fight in Vegas. You mean in terms of the fight itself or the arena or the people in attendance? Which part of it or all three?
Well, the arena, I think I've seen it down in Carson, California, but you must have
been... It was an outdoor arena at night. I felt as though I was a kid in the Yankee Stadium. That was the good part. And it was, remember, De La Hoya is a hero to the Hispanic community. He is their god, particularly in the sports figure. So this was filled with a lot of Hispanic people and a lot of black people. And I don't have to tell you that there's a lot of conflict between ethnic communities down here. There was not one fight in the arena that I saw.
And you left
I left in the third round for one reason. I'm sitting down there third from the, you know, third row. It would have taken me, looked like an hour at the end of the fight to walk back out of the, you had to go way up the grandstands to get out. It would have taken me an hour. You had to go through the entire arena to get out of there. And I didn't. I have a little claustrophobia. I didn't want to stay to the end. I didn't think the fight would go more than three or four rounds. So at the end of the third round, I left. I thought it was a dog the whole fight. He's a little paunchy in the midsection. The guy's 35, 36, 37. The black guy he was fighting was in far better shape. And I don't know. The whole thing looked a little bit staged to me, to be honest with you. He looked flabby around the middle. That's not to knock the guy. I'm sure he could knock me on my butt with a pinky. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is he's staging a fight because the next one's going to be his last one for the really big bucks, and he had to show he's still viable. But truthfully, I think he's way past his prime as a fighter, and I don't think he should be in the ring anymore. So, you know, it wasn't an exciting fight, to put it to you that way. I've seen far better.
Mayweather's going to take him out again if they fight again?
Who?
Mayweather, Floyd Mayweather.
Well, that's the big one. That's like the $100 million payoff. Mayweather's no spring chicken either, is he?
No, he's a lot better fighter, I think.
Well, let's hope doesn't happen to them what happened to the horses at Kentucky Derby.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Until there was a phone call, a guy next to us, and he looked and he said, "Your horse broke down." And I thought, not mine, maybe one of the horses that run bad in the race, but not mine, because I'd watched her go out of sight and everything was good. When I saw my jockey coming back on a horse with Donna Barton, that's not the way he's supposed to come back, and he jumped off and ran down and hugged me and explained to me that they're putting her down. If this horse had been shortening stride or Big Brown really getting away from her at the end or Dennis of Court flying by, we would have felt like maybe we ran a horse that was tired. But this filly, no one was catching her and no one was getting away from her. She held her own and ran hard all the way and was still on a perfect gallop out. That's what's so hard for us to understand how this could happen because everything went to plan.
Blue Monday. Got to work like a slave on deep. He'll come Tuesday. Oh,
that's
Tuesday.
It. So she ran her heart out with broken legs in order to please her owners and her trainers and her jockey. The poor girl ran and ran and ran with broken legs. She ran because she wanted to please the human master, and she's dead. And I'm telling you, you can call me any name under the sun. I know many of you are listening to, you know, the golfer says, "Well, it's good they shot that horse. You know, they should put her in a can." she's only a horse. And well, I don't see it that way. You know, maybe I'm a little soft when it comes to animals. I admit it. I don't know. I kind of like animals. I understand that I eat animals, and there's hypocrisy, I suppose, to a certain extent. But I don't eat dogs, and I don't eat horses. And I do think there's a hierarchy amongst animals. I don't think that they're all the same to me anyway. And when I see an animal used like this for profit, which is what it is, that's what horse racing is. It's a, you know, game for profit. And then when the horse is of no use to anyone anymore, they kill it on the track in front of the crowd, and they're that callous, and they think that people are not going to get upset. It just shows you how out of touch with reality they are. No, they didn't have to kill that horse, in my opinion. They did it for the insurance money, is how I see it, and I think that it was animal cruelty. And strangely enough, for the first time in my life, I agree with the extremist nut jobs in PETA. One, no racing or training for a thoroughbred until it turns three. I don't know about that entirely. They say that the animal's legs aren't fully developed until then. Two, no more racing on dirt tracks, use synthetic surfaces. Three, cap the number of times a horse races each year. And four, ban whipping. I agree with all of this. I don't know. It's something wrong with this picture. America is outraged by the euthanizing of that animal on the track, and that is one of the main stories. There are other stories that I'd like to talk about. I worked in the McCain campaign, which is he's euthanizing his own chances to be president. Either he has a stealth liberal running his campaign who wants him to lose, which is certainly possible, because it wouldn't be the first time this has happened. I believe that he has a Judas in his midst, and I don't think he's smart enough to even know it. I'm going to tell you right now, and that worries me even more. Because a smart leader, for example, should know when there's a Judas in the crowd. You can't always know it. I'm telling you, McCain has a Judas running his campaign. Every day I wake up, he's appealing to another left-wing group. Go ahead, do all you want with that. But then you give the middle finger over the weekend to the base that puts you in power, the conservative group, and say, we're not even going to talk to you. We're going to go for the blue-collar Democrat conservative, which I don't know how many there are, and the undecided, but we're not going to speak to the conservatives. You're committing Harry Caray. You're euthanizing your own campaign, John. And I really don't know if you know what you're doing with regard to this campaign. And I don't think you understand that you can't win without the conservative base. Trust me, I'm not voting for Obama. Trust me, I'm not voting for Hillary. But you're throwing the race to Hillary Clinton as sure as I'm sitting here without even knowing it. You may not even know you're doing that. But the people who are running your little race for you do know they're doing it. And I think you have Judases in your midst, John McCain. Now, there's the third issue that I'm going to introduce right now, which is Hillary, who's smart, running a very smart campaign, and she's running to the right. And that is her statement that she would nuke, well, she would destroy Iran if they nuked Israel. Listen to clips 7 and 8 back to back.
We need to make it very clear, like we did during the Cold War, where thousands of missiles were pointed at us and we pointed it at the Soviet Union, that there is a price to be paid. I said very clearly there would be massive retaliation. Mm-hmm. I'm communicating leaders of Iran and the people of Iran.
So just to be clear here, if Iran were to use nuclear weapons against Israel in a Clinton presidency, that attack would be met with a nuclear response against Iran?
It would be massive retaliation, John.
And does
massive
that mean,
retaliation.
Nuclear response?
Well, I think it speaks for itself.
Now, why would the man be trying to corner her with nuclear? What is that, a dirty word? So you mean they can drop a nuke on us, but we can't nuke them back? See, this is the American media. This is why not only are they useless, they're going to get us all killed. The American media may or may not know it, but they're Bolsheviks, every last one of them. With almost rare exception, if any exception at all in the midstream media, they are right out of the Bolshevik playbook. They hate this country to its core. They'd rather see the country die than stand up for itself, which is why I have no use for the mainstream or midstream media. So those are three topics. All I can say is good for Hillary for not backing down. You see, that's an interesting thing. They try to get her in a corner and say, you said you'd use massive retaliation. So then they corner her on it again. They figure she's going to backtrack, but she's not a Republican. She doesn't backtrack. She repeats that that's what she said and that's what she means. And I salute her for that. Absolutely. Now, on taxes and judges, I'd vote Republican. On taxes and judges, I would vote Republican. But that's not enough for me because I don't know where John McCain would be on judges. And I don't know where John McCain would be on taxes. I know that John McCain is distinguishable enough from the Kennedy clan and the Democrat Party to get too excited about this man. And I won't know until he comes on the show and commits to conservative judges and no increases in federal taxes because we're taxed to death. When he would say that, I'd say, okay, you got my vote. But he's never going to come on the show because he knows that he doesn't know what he's going to say because they haven't told him yet what his position should be. That's all. That's my opinion. Three topics, many callers, phone number 1-800-449-8255, website, thegreatmichaelsavage.com, 1.5 million uniques a month. It's astonishing what's happening to this show and this website. They say, oh, radio's on the way down. No, you're wrong. Terrestrial radio is on the way up for many reasons. And number two, my website is phenomenal. It now beats Hannity's website. What does that tell you? What does that tell you? Ralph on WR. What do you say? What do you know, Ralph? What's on your mind?
I'm so glad you're shedding light on this, the travesties that go on in this sport they call the sport of kings. You know, the inbreeding that goes on causes the horses to form hip and joint ailments that they would not normally have. First of all, the filly should never run with the other horses in the race. That's the biggest. That's one of the.
All right, let's explain that to the average listener. A filly means a female horse, correct?
And she has no business. Although she's won, they've won in the past, and that's what other people will bring that fact up. But she has no business running in this field.
You're saying the males are stronger than her?
Yes, and also then the field is so large, Michael. You have 20 horses. Now, it doesn't take only a layman will be able to tell you, when they approach that gate and you see 20 animals of that size at that gate and they're set to go, that's thousands and thousands of pounds on with tangled feet on that track at once. It's far too many horses. This has only been done, I would say, the last 25 years. They never would run that many horses, but because of the money.
Oh, greed. In other words, greed. In other words, more horses means more betting. Is that it?
Of course, Michael. I mean,
greed. Everything has to be greed, 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 greed. There's no end to it. That's why the country's gone bankrupt.
Well, Michael, you know also, and it's very true about PETA. You know, I don't agree with them on mostly anything, but I'll say this: 3 years old, it's much too. The bones have not developed in these horses. They're 3 years old. They have no business on that track at that age. And one last thing about the jockeys: these people, they're very small men to begin with, but they have to make an impossible weight of about 90 pounds thereabouts, and they have to do this by sitting in a sweat box and by purging like a bulimic, and it's just an inhumane sport on many, many levels, Michael.
Now, Ralph, are you at all involved in the animal world? Are you a veterinarian, or how do you know all of this?
My father was, not myself, because I saw all the injustices.
Oh, so you grew up in the horse world?
When I was a kid.
Where? Out at which field? Roosevelt, the Trots?
In California.
Oh, amazing. Well, I'm a layman. I don't know much about horses, but I know a lot about animal cruelty. And as far as I'm concerned, what I saw was inhumane. And I believe there should be an investigation of both trainer, owner, and jockey. Agree or disagree?
Well, Michael, you're absolutely right. And, you know, the fact that you see that, someone that's not in the horse world, I mean, they think that people that will let everything go by, because we let so much go by. You know how it is, Michael.
Yes, of course. We're overwhelmed by insult. Our senses are overwhelmed by insult. But when you see a beautiful, noble animal break her legs, doesn't even know her legs are broken because she ran her heart out. She wanted to please that jockey. She was saying, yes, sir. She's running with broken legs, and then she's of no use, and they put her to death on a track? Are they insane? People are, of course, are going to talk about it.
Michael, that you have the guts to say that it is done for insurance purposes, that's something that no one else has broached yet, and that is so true. The inhumanity of it is so apparent that anyone that doesn't see it is half dead, in my opinion.
Well, thank you for saying I see it. What else do I see? A few weeks ago, I told you that Obama's pastor's racist, anti-American, insulting commentary towards white people would seriously cost Obama at the polls. For 2 weeks, the midstream media said, No effect. It's having no effect. The latest poll from Rasmussen and the other Schmendricks is saying, oh, no, there's no effect, no effect. Now, all of a sudden today, they're saying Obama's pastor is having an effect on Obama. I'm weeks ahead of them in the media. I run leagues ahead of everybody in the media. I see things as they are. I don't need to read it to know it. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is 23 minutes after the hour. Can you imagine if your dog broke both of her front legs while she was running and chasing a ball with you? And within a minute of her breaking her legs and you discovering it, you gave her a needle and killed her. You'd say that's insane. Go to michaelsavage.com if you feel like having your guts ripped out and you feel like getting really angry. And look at the picture of that horse. Look at her face seconds before they kill her. And I said, they shoot horses, don't they? Then I ask, why do we permit this barbaric slaughter? The owner should be jailed. That's my opinion. It's one man's opinion. I know that this is a controversial statement. I've read all of the justification for euthanizing horses, and I'm not so sure I agree with any of it, by the way. I think it's all about insurance. Again, I want to reiterate, they will pay insurance on a horse that must be euthanized, okay? But no insurance company in the world is going to underwrite the care for an animal that has broken legs and is of no longer any service whatsoever. No one's going to pay the millions of dollars a year. So this is a mercenary, unnecessary slaughter of a noble creature. Also on michaelsavage.com on the right side, Obama's new pastor quotes F America, KKKA rap song. So don't tell me Obama's spirituality is not connected up with Trinity United Church. It is the core of the man. I personally think Obama's a decent person, but I think Obama's soul has been contaminated by the teachings of Reverend Wright. I also think that it's not Obama that I fear as much as I do the people he'd appoint who would lead us right into the Bolshevik Revolution that occurred in communist Russia. Now let's go to the callers. Portland, Oregon, KXL. Jim, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Savage, I'm a farrier, and I'd like to weigh in on the horse racing issue. Hello?
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go.
Oh, sorry. I've been a farrier for 25 years, and structurally, there's a problem with the jockey club itself, starting with that all horses are a year old at the age at January 1st, which means that some are competing as yearlings when they're 6 months old. Their first futurities start at a year and are expected to be broken and trained by the time they're 18 months, which means they start them at a year. You know, so when they say to raise...
So well, you're a blacksmith for the average person. Are you suggesting you agree that horses should not be run till they're three?
Oh, I would put the age at four. The problem is, okay, in the third metacarpal, which is that long bone, also referred to as the cannon bone, in a thoroughbred, all breeds. My father raised thoroughbreds. I own thoroughbreds, and thoroughbreds. There's a spot in them called the nutrient foramen where material comes from the blood marrow. I mean, from the bone marrow, and there's like a little hole there. That nutrient foramen doesn't close and become bone until they're like three. And
oh,
so
my
you're,
God.
Yes, yeah, I mean, it's insane.
So that would be like taking a baby who has soft regions of his skull, a human baby, the fontanella, and putting the baby into a headbutting contest before he has a full skull.
So, absolutely. So,
I mean, I'm sorry to put it in such dramatic terms, but there is a soft part of a baby's skull, as most people know, if they have had a baby, that remains soft while the brain is developing and the skull is forming. Would you put a baby with an undeveloped skull in a headbutting contest? What you're saying is they should understand that you can't do that with a horse as well. Thank you. Coming up next, we're short on time, is the four-time heavyweight champion Evander Holyfield on the Savage Nation. Now you say, well, that's a strange topic. Well, it's an interesting book, A Fighter's Journey by Evander Holyfield. And as you well know, fighting or any other endeavor where there's such incredible competition involved is a lot of mental and a lot of spiritual involved. It's not just brawn. So I decided to have Evander Holyfield on the show. He's a four-time heavyweight champion. He's an Olympic medalist. And he's 44 years old, and he's on a quest for a fifth world heavyweight championship. They say he can't do it, but they've told him that he was too small to be a heavyweight. and he won the world championship four times. They said he couldn't go the distance. He won a first world title in 15 rounds of one of the most grueling matches ever fought. And that is Evander Holyfield on the Savage Nation. You're not going to want to miss it. Be here.
Savage.
We're going to switch now from the racetrack to the ring, and we're going to speak with a four-time heavyweight champion, Olympic medalist, all-around great man, Evander Holyfield, with us on the Savage Nation. Mr. Holyfield, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for being on the show. Now, you're 44 years old. You're on a quest for a fifth world heavyweight championship. You've had surgery to repair your shoulders, and yet you're willing to go on. Who are you going to be fighting for that championship?
Well, I don't know. At this time, you know, they do three different names, but, you know, the title change is all depend. Klitschko is one of the champion, and guy from Nigeria.
I met Klitschko at a fight in Vegas, and I asked him about fighting, and he said to me, as much as it is physical, it's also mental. Would you agree with that? That it's a lot to do with the mind.
Yes, it's definite. I think it's 80% mental and 20% physical.
That's an interesting statement coming from two great men. I mean, you won the heavyweight championship four times. I read your papers here. It says you spent your life proving the critics wrong. They said you were too small to be a heavyweight, and yet you won the world championship four times. And that's because you had the will to fight. Is that what you're saying? And you were smarter than the fighters you were fighting?
Well, you know, it's a combination of a lot of things. You know, it's that definite. It's about faith. You have to have faith, but you do have to have skills, and you have to be willing to be able to take whatever someone give you, but be able to switch it. You have to. It's a lot of adjustments you have to make in the course of a 12-round fight.
So you don't know what's coming at you, and you got to be able to be flexible, just like life itself. And speaking about that, you've had some pretty emotionally wrenching moments in your life. The murder of your beloved older brother. You lost your mother as a result of a car accident. You had a heart ailment that nearly ended your career. How did you overcome all these things? What is your faith based upon, Mr. Holyfield?
My faith is based upon the word of the Lord, Jesus Christ. You know, I'm brought up that way. From my background, youngest at nine, in a bad neighborhood, but you know, what we had is, you know, my grandmother and my mother, we believe in the Word of God, and we believe in Jesus, and we learned to be able to apply the words, and from there, here I am.
Now, you've beaten some of the greats. You beat Buster Douglas, George Foreman, Larry Holmes, Lennox Lewis. You even beat Mike Tyson. What was that fight like?
Well, I'm
just... Wait a minute. This is you write with compelling detail in your new book called Becoming Holyfield of the infamous 1997 fight where Tyson bit off a part of your ear. I mean, that's something that even the average listener who doesn't know boxing knows about. What the heck was that like?
Well, I'm telling you, it was a shocking type situation because you know Mike being as you know good a fighter as he is and his reputation, you know, but it, you know, that's something that you never would have expected that two great athletes and that time in their life and somebody bit someone. That just, it was just shocking. And but I guess the most important thing is forgiveness. You know, I was able to forgive him and move on.
Well, that's pretty well stated. So of all your fights, which was your toughest? And I don't mean just your fights in the ring. Of all the fights in the ring and outside, what was your toughest fight, Evander?
Yeah, tough is tough, you know, but I truly believe that...
But how are you going to, at age 40, but isn't it unusual for you, at a man at 44, to go back in the ring? How can you do that? In other words, isn't this a young man's game?
Well, you know, this is what someone tell you. Someone always want to, in one way or another, tell you what they feel that you should do. I'm saying, you know, when a person trained themselves, when a person is willing to make the sacrifice themselves and willing to, you know, step up to the plate and be all that they can be, it's kind of sad how the first thing somebody say, you're too old, you're too small, is always something. You know, practically all my life, it was always something. And I learned to, you know, well, I hear what they said, but I'm going to stay focused and that's the only thing I can do, stay focused.
No, I hear you. So, right, you got to overcome what people say to you and do what you know has got to be done for you. The book is Becoming Holyfield, A Fighter's Journey. Evander Holyfield, I wish you great success, and you're a great, inspiring man. Thank you very much for being with us on the Savage Nation. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, my friend. Well, there it is. Here's another example of what motivates a man. And I didn't know that he was a spiritual man, a religious man. I didn't know he was a Christian man in that regard. But you heard it on the Savage Nation. It comes back again to faith and what motivates people, what's inside them as much as what you see on the outside. You know, you see people sometimes in a ring. I don't know what it is. Whatever the competition may be. Sometimes you see a smaller man and you see he's not that well built. You say, how is this man going to beat the other man? I've seen it over and over again where the guy who doesn't look that tough can whip, you know, the other guy. Why? It's that unknown hidden factor that drives men. And it's the same in every endeavor. I don't care whether you're an insurance salesman. I don't care what it is you do. If you're driven more than your competitor, you're going to beat him every time. I know it's true in the radio business. I start late in the day. I'm not on major stations in some markets, and yet the show is the third-ranked show in the country. Can you imagine what the show would be in terms of if I was on bigger stations at an earlier time? I could whip the competition. I don't want to get in the ring with the leprechaun who's number 5 or 6 because he's liable to bite my ear off, and I got to be very careful. I don't know whether or not he has rabies, and it's another story. Thank God that Mr. Holyfield didn't get rabies from that bite. But when it comes to the radio business, you can't tell whether your competitor has rabies or not. Sacramento Charles, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Mike, man, you're amazing. How can you have Evander, the real deal, Holyfield, go from politics to Evander to just what's next? What do you have next in store for the people here on the Savage Nation?
Well, you notice that the show is changing a little bit over the year, Charles, where I'm incorporating a little broader stuff, whether it's sports or whatever, because if you find the common thread in all of it, it all connects up. And so in the case of Evander Holyfield, the connection would be, A, his spirituality, which I really didn't know about, and B, the fact that he has an interesting life story to go with his ring story. And I thought that those two elements would be of interest to listeners, and in your case, it certainly is true. I don't know whether it's true for the millions of others who tune in on a regular basis. I don't think you tune in expecting to hear sports talk on this show, do you?
You turn it to a sports talk because your son has the cars, and I mean, I can just see you going to, instead of being a politics, going into a different realm to catch more of an audience out there. You have that capability.
I don't know. It could happen. I don't know, but there is a bigger world than just Hillary and McCain and Obama, isn't there? I mean, there's a bigger world out there.
No, there is so much, and I'm a independent conservative, and I am 28 years old, and I'm honestly tired of politics. I'm tired of talking to my friends about politics because they are more of a being on the feeling instead of actually listening to the topic and listening to what the people
are saying. They absolutely they'll go with emotions, which politicians know very well how to exploit. Trust me on that one. They appeal to their emotions, with feel-good messages. Well, I'm glad I reached you, and I thank you very much for being a regular listener of the Savage Nation. Again, I advise you to go to michaelsavage.com. There's another story I don't want you to miss at all. Here's one. Antipsychotic drugs overprescribed to American kids. I've been writing about it since 1982. I have told you, our children are being drugged to death. A new study says American children take antipsychotic medicines at 6 times the rate of children in Britain. Why? Greed. They're making up diseases that don't exist in order to prescribe drugs that are unnecessary, which are turning our children into into psychotics themselves. So read that article and make sure that you think three times before you addict your child to a drug. 1-800-449-8255. Again, I wrote the book Healing Children Naturally in 1982, and it's reissued for you. Ritalin poses child crime risk. Read the articles. Here's another one that you're not going to want to miss on michaelsavage.com. Clinton Library won't release Berger documents. I'm not surprised by that. They're hiding something. National Security Advisor Sandy the Burglar illegally took documents from the National Archives in 03. Remember that story? And now they won't release what documents that he stole. Why? Well, they're saying it's confidential. They're hiding something. What they're hiding is probably very important. We'll never know, at least not in our lifetime. It'll take historians to figure out if they don't burn the records. Denver, Colorado, next caller up on line 5. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. You had excellent seats for the fight on Saturday night. I saw you about fourth row back. Is that correct?
Where were you? Were you in the ring? I mean, ringside?
On HBO. I was actually looking for you in the audience, and I happened to see you. I think Bernard Hopkins was maybe one row in front of you, over one, and then Sylvester Stallone was maybe about 6 seats over and two rows up from you. You were like in the fourth row back.
And what was what kind of hat was I wearing?
Then it wasn't you then. I didn't see you wearing it.
No, I specifically wore a small Gucci fedora because I knew nobody at a boxing match would dare wear a Gucci fedora for fear they'd get killed. No, I was on another side of the ring, but I was in the third row, but that was funny. I mean, you know, the guys are wearing baseball hats. It was a combination of the hood and Apocalypto in the arena. But I never saw a police that was so big. The L.A. sheriffs, man, these guys are enormous. You talk about pumping iron. These guys could be in the movies. I never saw forearms like this. These guys were standing there with their arms folded. They were as big as any of the gangbangers out there, and they were very intimidating because they had the guns and the clubs. No, it was a very, very well-controlled crowd, and not the least of which, in terms of why, were these incredible L.A. County Sheriff's Department guys. My hat's off to them. I remember at one point in between rounds 2 and 3 when I was getting a little, like, panic attack of how am I going to get out of here because it was, like, all the way across, all the way up, 45 minutes out. And I didn't want to wait to the end. I went up to one of the sheriffs. He was a black guy. And I said to him, blah, blah, blah. Is there any other way out of here other than there? He says, no, you got to walk all the way up there. I said, is there any other way out? He says, yeah, I'll carry you out. I said, no, thanks. You don't have to do that. So I left after the third round. You know, from now on, I think I'm going to watch it on HBO or on Showtime, wherever it occurs. You know, it's a little better. You can get up. You can go out. You can do this. You can switch around. I mean, last night I was so bored down here. I watched Godfather 3, which in the trilogy has to be the worst of them, but still entertaining compared to what they make today. And again, the most astonishing mistake in that movie was not making the lead lady like a star and using the director's daughter. And I'm not trying to knock her. I mean, she's probably a great person, but she shouldn't have been in that role, and that's what killed it. The young Andy Garcia was fantastic in the role. And, you know, rewatching it, he was much better than Pacino. Not that Pacino was bad, but just watching this movie again. Sometimes you see a movie years later, you get another judgment. The directing was very wooden. It was jumpy. Compared to the first two, it looked absolutely like summer stock. I'll be right back. It is Rock and Roll Monday on the Savage Nation. Why do I have to wait till Friday to have a good time? Where is it written I have to do that?
Yes, you appeal to me.
Maybe if I went back to my teenage self, I'd be a happier man. I think I'll get a crew cut. Well, it wasn't exactly a crew cut. I don't know if I can get peg pants anymore. They don't make them. They should make a comeback soon. They were great pants. We are talking about They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Boxing, the strange case of John McCain running a terribly self-defeating campaign, Hillary running a much smarter campaign, about Savage being ahead of everybody in the media, predicting that Obama's pastor would have a devastating effect upon him for all the reasons I described. And I've told you for 25 years, of course, in my writings, in addition to my show, that our children are being drugged into submission by an oppressive authoritarian society so that they will be compliant for the state school system, which further dumbs them into idiots to make them into compliant fools who will really not even know where Cuba is. They don't know who Castro was. They don't know who Adolf Hitler is. They don't know which side he fought on. They don't never heard of Joseph Stalin. It's astonishing to me, this conspiracy of dumbness. This is the Savage Nation. I try in my own way to take on every topic and give one man's opinion based upon A, intuition, and B, fact. And now we're going to go back to the callers. Buffalo, New York. Kevin, go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation.
Say hello, Dr. Savage. It was sometime in, maybe about 8 years ago, I was carrying a bunch of stuff, and it was all falling out of my hands. And a big, towering gentleman, and I do call him a real gentleman, humility, everything, he just stopped me and said, hey, wait a minute, and picked up some stuff in my hands, and so on. And then afterwards, one of my buddies said, do you know who that is, man? I said, no, who? Evander Holyfield. I said, get out of here. No way.
Where, Michael, well, Kevin, where was this, when you were working a job?
Yeah. And I'll tell you something, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm starstruck, but I really want to say that he makes me feel proud to be a human. You know what I'm saying? Because
Yes, I do. And there's a man who can transcend race. I assume that you're not of African American descent.
No, I am. I'm mixed. I'm a Heinz 57. So. And
all right. Well, I'm glad the interview touched you in a positive way. I really am. What would you like to talk about? Politics, horses, Polish resistance. Don't forget the most important story I told today, which is not my story, it's someone else's, escape from a death train. I'll tell it again because it's inspiring. You know, maybe I should refresh it again, okay? I'm in L.A. I'm at lunch with some young people in their 20s. Never knew the background of any of these young people. I don't know how it came up. It came up that this guy's grandmother was 16 years old on a train, a death train going to the death camp. She had her younger brother dead in her arms. The younger brother was 14 years old. Now, what would that do to you? It would devastate the average American to the point where they would be insane and couldn't function. I guess you'd need healing and closure, and you'd need little balloons and teddy bears and prescriptions and psychiatrists. Well, guess what? There's something stronger in you, because this woman knew she was going to her death. Everyone in the car was crying and frightened. She climbed out of the top window of a cattle car, threw herself out of a moving train, fell in the snow. The German on the top with the gun shot her twice, once through the arm and once through the leg. They left her for dead in the snow because the train saw a child there laying with blood, and they sped away, and they thought she was dead. Polish farmers, Christians, took this Jewish girl in, nursed her back to health. The girl said, I'm going to get out of here, because if I don't, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. They probably would have been killed. She found her way to the Warsaw Ghetto, which, as you well know, was obliterated by the Nazis. She was a sniper in the Polish resistance and survived the war to come to America, to come to California, to have a child who had a child who I had lunch with today. What I'm saying is each of us is a miracle. Perhaps not as dramatic as that, but in your ancestral past, people have had to make decisions. God knows what happened to them. And so you have to understand that when you think you can't go on, or you're weak, I need closure, I need therapy, you don't need anything. You know, you don't need anything. This is a society that makes you think you're a weakling and you need prescription drugs and you need treatment and you need therapy. You don't need anything. Find it in yourself, for God's sakes. The therapist ought to slap you around and say, stop whimpering. Stop crying. You have it good. You want to hear tragedy? I'll tell you tragedy. I'll tell you about a little girl whose brother died in her arms, and she had to jump out of a train, and she was shot, and she survived. Go ahead, play Act Like a Man. Go ahead, play
Godfather,
it.
I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. You can act like a man. What's the matter with you? Is this how you turn down a Hollywood Pinocchio that cries like a woman? What can I do? What can I do?
Well, guess what? Maybe if America had a president like that, we'd be a great country again. Instead of promising prescription drugs. I'm sorry a cyclone hit a Burma, Myanmar. Where's he getting the money from? Where, what basement is he printing it in? He went down into the Federal Reserve and they ran the presses for Myanmar. What are these people, nuts? We're nuts. It's not 1950. We don't have unlimited money. No, we need a president who says, I'm sorry you were hit, but we have troubles here. Okay? I don't understand how this country can survive unless we get a real tough man running this country. And unfortunately, I don't see it right now. I see wimps, wimps, and more wimps.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is Rock and Roll Monday on the Savage Nation. We're talking about terrible topics. I had to counter it with some happy music. I mean, when you see a horse euthanized on a track, and you know it's for the insurance money, and then, you know, where do you go from there? If you just tuned in, you missed a great interview with Evander Holyfield. You missed the story of escape from a death train. You missed should the jockey be arrested for animal cruelty. You missed should there be investigation of insurance fraud on the horse track. You missed my attendance at the De La Hoya fight and my observations. You missed the biggest story that I haven't even told you about. Now, when you were in the Savage classroom on Friday, remember I said to you there was breaking news right at the end of the show about the conservative sweep in England, where the liberal communists were thrown out after decades of destroying England and of kowtowing to the invasion by various and sundry illegal immigrants and others, asylees, and that the conservatives won. And I said, watch what happens. This is going to be swept under the table by the midstream media. Have you read about it anywhere? No, you haven't even read it on the internet. It appeared on one site for a few minutes. Now, the media ignored the massive conservative win in Britain. Why? Do you think England has awakened in time to avoid a Muslim Europe? They were calling it Londonistan. Do you think that they can save it? Do you actually think England is going to be saved again? And do you really believe that you have a fair media when they'll cover up a gigantic victory for conservatives in England? Now, ask yourself why they swept that. I'm talking 400 seats in Parliament. The Labour left was thrown out. The Conservative Party was swept in. Why would you think the midstream media would not want you to see that story? It should have been a major league story in this country. Banner headlines in every newspaper. Why wasn't it? Because then it would be very bad for the communist socialist left in the Obama camp. It would have been very, very bad for the far liberal Hillary camp. And it would have been good for the sort of liberal McCain, because he is the least of the three problems. He is by no means a conservative. Make no mistake about that. He has already given the middle finger to the conservatives. He's opened up a Spanish website. He is wooing Hispanics. He's given the middle finger to conservatives. He said, we don't need you. We don't need the base. He's wrong. He's not going to win. And the reason he thinks he owns you. He doesn't understand you have an option three. The option three is not going out to vote. That's something the stupid Republicans will never understand. They're arrogant. They're autocratic and arrogant, and they think they own you. They don't understand that they don't live in Tsarist Russia, where you don't have a choice. This is not Tsarist Russia. It's America. And it is not Africa. It's not Zimbabwe. It is America. You have a third choice, which is not to vote at all. That may be your most powerful vote entirely. Not to vote is a very powerful statement, by the way. And if the McCain idiots continue to say, well, we're going to appeal to this group, that group, but not the conservatives, my prediction is a very dim prognosis for the McCain camp. That's all I could say. So we're talking about all these topics. I don't have much time because I have a great interview I did earlier that I'm going to play. Let's go quickly to WOR in New York. Sean, please make it as quickly as possible. Go ahead.
Hi, Michael. Michael, you know, I feel disgusted by what happened the other day at this horse race, and it reminded me of of a novel that I know you like, Animal Farm by George Orwell. The poor horse reminds me of Boxer. You know, once they get everything out of this horse, they make, you know what I mean? You know.
Yes. Remember what? Sure. Orwell wrote about Boxer, where the animals conducted a revolution, killed a farmer, took over the farm, and Boxer, who was the strongest of them, was used, and then when he couldn't pull anymore, they killed him. Yeah. You know what it was? I'll tell you. You want to go get into the psychology of it? We all feel like we're eight bells. There's a part of us that's that horse on the track. We all feel we're going to run our heart out, and we would hope that there's a little more humanity at the end of the track than a needle from the trainer saying she cannot be saved. I mean, that's what it comes down to. See, we're fundamentally a humane people. We're a compassionate people. That's what makes us a great people. This wouldn't even be a story in Spain. It wouldn't be a story in Mexico where they kill bulls. You understand that? It's a different culture. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, Michael. Mike,
you may say, does that make us soft? Does that make us stronger for having compassion? I'll be right back. Be here.
Savage.
Aaron Klein, Jerusalem correspondent for WorldNet Daily, has been doing some research on Obama, Carter, and their relationship with the terrorist organization Hamas. He is here to tell us what he's found out. Aaron Klein, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me on again.
You telling me Hamas is endorsing a U.S. presidential candidate?
Yeah, Michael. It's actually official now. The Hamas terrorist organization has officially endorsed Barack Obama for president. I'm not kidding you. Just a little while ago, I did an interview with Ahmed Youssef, who's the senior political advisor to the Hamas terrorist organization in the Gaza Strip. Ahmed Youssef is basically the political architect of Hamas. He's Western educated. He knows quite a bit about American politics, about European politics. And during the course of the interview, and we have audio that we're going to play on the Savage Nation. During the course of the interview, this Hamas leader and Hamas political architect said that he hopes, and his Hamas organization hopes, that Barack Obama will win the presidential elections in the United States and change America's foreign policy. He actually said that he likes Mr. Obama, and he compared Barack Obama to John F. Kennedy. He said that both of them are great men with great principles, and they have a great vision to change America.
Yeah, well, let's hear the clip.
We don't mind. Actually, we like Mr. Obama, and we hope that he will the election. And I do believe he's like John Kennedy, great man with a great principle.
And now you have Ahmed Youssef, the political architect, political advisor to Hamas in Gaza, endorsing Barack Obama. And I didn't even ask him during the interview who he favored. He just went on and on about Barack Obama.
Okay, so there is a Hamas official that wants Obama to be elected. What do you think that means?
Well, you can go onto the Gaza Strip, and you won't believe this. Actually, in Gaza, they have formed different youth groups, teenagers who are going around in different internet cafes in Gaza and actually going online and trying to urge Americans through emails to vote for Barack Obama. So we have Gazans who are working for him. And actually, apparently, if you look further into the overall story of Barack Obama and Hamas, it's very interesting. You have Obama's church newsletter, the very famous Trinity United Church of Christ. I'm sure we all know this church. And on the church newsletter, on the pastor page of Reverend Jeremiah Wright, they've actually reprinted, among other things, an official Hamas opinion piece where Hamas basically compares its charter, which calls for the murder of Jews, they compare that to the Declaration of Independence and then go on, and this is a Hamas official whose opinion piece is being reprinted in Obama's church newsletter. They go on and they compare Hamas resistance to other resistance in the past. They don't use the word terrorism. You go and you look at who is Senator Barack Obama and what was he doing before he ran for president. And one thing that's incredible and that hasn't received much media attention, I found that Barack Obama, among other things, he was going around in the 1990s, the late 1990s, and raising money for Palestinian causes. For one thing, he attended, and he was one of the main speakers at a fundraiser, raising money for Palestinian so-called refugees. These are foreign Arabs who say that they're Palestinian and that they were kicked out of their homes in 1948. And Obama has been going around raising money for them. This is actually a very extremist thing, raising money for Palestinian refugees. And one person who was present at this event is a well-known pro-Palestinian activist. His name is Ali Abu Nima. And Abu Nima said something very interesting. He said that Barack Obama told him a little bit later in 2004 that for now he really can't say much about Palestine because he's in a tough primary race. He was running in 2004 for the Senate. But Barack Obama apparently told this Palestinian activist, I'm hoping when things calm down, I can be more upfront about Palestine. More upfront about Palestine. What does that mean? Does that mean that Barack Obama has some sort of other agenda when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue that he's not speaking up about?
What did you dig up about Obama's advisors?
One is a guy named Robert Malley, who is one of his foreign policy advisors. And Robert Malley has actually, get this, he's petitioned in opinion pieces in the Washington Post, in the New York Times, for America and the European Union to create dialogue with Hamas. So there's an Obama advisor who's actually publicly going around and calling for negotiations and dialogue with Hamas. You have another Obama advisor, and this is actually Obama's campaign co-chairman and his chief military advisor, Merrill McPeak, who has given interviews where he implied that Jews in America are the problem impeding a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So in other words, it's not the terrorists who are shooting at Jews and firing rockets into Jewish population centers that is impeding peace, according to Obama's military advisor. It's actually Jewish voters who are right-wing in New York and Miami. You have another Obama advisor, actually a former advisor, Samantha Power. She quit about a month and a half ago because she made controversial statements about Hillary Clinton. But Power was going around and talking about actually advocating giving money to the state of Palestine instead of giving money to the Israeli military. That's a Barack Obama campaign advisor.
Obama's views on Palestine are starting to sound just like Jimmy Carter.
Indeed. Yeah, and all of this comes after the very famous visit, very well covered by the media, of Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter, who went tried to go to the Gaza Strip. He met in Egypt with senior Hamas officials, and then he went over to Syria, where he met with Hamas's chief, Khaled Meshal, and other Hamas leaders. And what he basically talked to them about, and this is really important, he talked with Hamas about creating some sort of ceasefire with Israel. And then after Jimmy Carter came here, it was announced that Carter had this great breakthrough that he's going to achieve a 10-year truce, a 10-year ceasefire with Israel. Well, actually, this is no breakthrough. Hamas has been trying to push through this 10-year ceasefire with Israel for about 3-4 years now, and they explain to anyone who listens that the ceasefire is actually an attempt to ultimately defeat the Jewish state. The ceasefire that was pushed through by Carter, it actually calls for Israel to evacuate the entire West Bank, the entire Eastern Jerusalem, including the Temple Mount. And if Israel evacuates all of this, and the entire West Bank, even leftist political parties in Israel don't call for the Jewish state to give up that much territory. So basically, if Israel withdraws to truncated Auschwitz borders, then Hamas will cease firing on Israel for up to 10 years. This is the great truce that was pushed through by Jimmy Carter. And Barack Obama didn't really have much to say about Jimmy Carter's visit. He condemned Hamas as a terror group, but Obama wouldn't specifically condemn Carter. He said that Carter is a free person. He's an individual who can do whatever he wants. So we really need to know, going into this election, who it is that Barack Obama really stands for, what it is he stands for. And when it comes to Hamas, when it comes to terrorism, does he agree with Hamas or does he condemn them? We don't know.
Well, how serious is the world taking Carter?
You know, I'll tell you that Hamas, when Jimmy Carter came to visit these Hamas terrorists, they expressed absolute hope that they believe that now Jimmy Carter will help end the isolation of the Hamas terror group. And this is very real, because Hamas is telling me, they said in several interviews, that Europe, that members of the European Union, that parliamentary members from the UK, also some officials from the government in Italy, in Norway, and in France, all these governments, apparently, Hamas claims, have held quiet, secretive meetings with the Hamas terrorist organization over the last year, year and a half. But the Europeans really haven't had the confidence to go public about these meetings. And so Hamas is hoping that Jimmy Carter really would end the international embargo and really give the authority to Europeans to then go public and announce that they've also talked with Hamas. And I truly believe that in the near future, maybe not a few weeks, but probably a few months from now, you're going to have some European countries that create open dialogue with Hamas. And Hamas is also very interestingly claiming, they won't mention any names, but they've claimed in interviews that they also met with prominent members of the Democratic Party aside from Jimmy Carter, apparently advisors to different Democratic officials, but they wouldn't name just who it is that from the Democratic Party that Hamas is claiming to have met. And when you tie everything together, Obama's church, Obama's advisors, Obama's statements are really not condemning Jimmy Carter's visit with Hamas, it really begs the question, does Hamas have any link, any relationship with Barack Obama or any of his advisors? And to that, I think we're just going to have to pay close attention to the news to find the answers.
Aaron Klein, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Michael, thanks so much for having me on. Can't wait to come on again.
Savage.
You can always bet on the Savage Nation. And here are some of the other stories. Look, the horse story is big. They shoot horses, don't they? Why do we permit this barbaric slaughter? You've got to go to michaelsavage.com and see a heartbreaking picture of the last minutes of 8 Bell's life. Here she is struggling with broken legs, raising her noble head. And there you have people deciding her life and killing her on the track, saying she's of no use to us anymore. We need the insurance, basically. Another big story that you should not ignore on my website is execution has been set for the illegal alien on death row. It's an important story because this Mexican-born Texas death row inmate had a sentence of death. And George Bush sided with the rapist killer and said that he is entitled to a trial in the world court. That's right. Your conservative, George Bush, did everything that you feared a liberal would do, only more. And sided against the Texas Supreme Court. It had to go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which said to Mr. Bush, you're wrong. This is the United States of America, not the world court. And now this rapist murderer is set to be executed. The man is named Medellin. They said that George Bush overstepped his authority by trying to order the state of Texas, to reopen his case, and the cases of 50 others born in Mexico. I don't know what country this man is running anymore. I have no idea. I never heard of anything like this. This man should have been executed 15 years ago. He's been living longer than the girl he tortured and raped and killed. Did you hear that? They euthanized the horse within 2 seconds, 2 minutes. Here's a man who tortured and murdered a 14-year-old girl. Tortured her and murdered her. And he's been alive longer on death row than she was. Once again, he ain't no Mexican. It proves once again he ain't no Texan. Once again, it proves once again that Bush ain't no Texan. You hear this? I never saw anything like this. This is incomprehensible, but one day we'll find out what this is about Mr. Bush that is so strange, I hope. Here's another story that you should not ignore on the MichaelSavage.com. We linked it up from the LA Times. Chinese companies bargain hunting in U.S. They are buying factories. They are buying real estate. They are building factories. And they're here and they're shopping. They're on a shopping spree. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. As far as I'm concerned, it's a good thing, so long as they're not buying sensitive defense-related industries, okay? But when you see that China's sovereign wealth fund took in Morgan Stanley last year in a $5 billion stake, or that the state-owned oil giant CNOOC Limited's tried to buy an $18.5 billion bid to acquire Unocal Corp, which was blocked in 2005, you recognize that unless foreign governments, because remember, there's no such thing as a foreign business when it comes to China. They're basically government agencies, the big ones. And they're trying to buy this country's infrastructure up from the bottom out. So, look, for years, investment between the U.S. and China flowed one way, with American firms spending billions in the Asian nation. But now, with a $5 billion stake in Morgan Stanley, with a $3 billion buy into the Blackstone Group, China's overall investments in the U.S. firms brought it to almost $10 billion in 2007, up from $36 million the year before. By comparison, the U.S. invested in China was $2.6 billion last year, down from $3 billion in 2006. So that's one thing, but we don't know who the Chinese entrepreneurs who have been buying here and want to keep a low profile. They fly under the official radar, and I don't know what they've bought. I don't know. Let's go to the callers on the Savage Nation, Las Vegas, Nevada. Mick, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Michael, in pre-Second World War Hungary, my mother had a premonition that forbade her to have her two sons be circumcised. She said that if we would get circumcised, we would all be killed. In 1942, 8 years after I was born, my father's activity, which was to set up safe houses for French escaped prisoners of war throughout Europe, led us to live in Berlin after all the Jews have all been exterminated out of Germany. Hmm. And next door to us lived an SS officer who constantly asked me and my brother to accompany him to a swimming pool.
Oh, my God.
Which we one day did. And we got there, and he told us, okay, get undressed, and we'll go swimming. And we did. Of course, we were not circumcised because my mother fought tooth and nail to prohibit that when we were born. And this SS officer, I think, took us there because he wanted to see whether we were Jewish or not. And
sure.
Being that we were not circumcised, he let us go.
Unbelievable. So, what a story. How did this end?
Well, it ended very well. We emigrated to the United States. I'm 74 years old. My brother is 72. I love this country. I kiss the ground proverbially every single day that I'm an American, and I love it.
I hear you. You heard my story on escape from a death train, obviously, which is what provoked your call.
I need to call you. That's what prompted me to call you.
Well, you know, these stories need to be told over and over again. We know about the terrible tragedy and the murders of the Jews and the others who fought against Hitler. Some who never fought at all, including a million Jewish children who were killed for no reason other than being the wrong race in the wrong country at the wrong time. But the stories of those who fought and fought back are very important, Mick, to give us the courage to go on, because most of us think that our problems, our very small problems in America, are much bigger than they really are in proportion to the world and what people have gone through. So when I hear Americans crying and complaining, I remember history. And it doesn't limit itself only to the Jewish people. You take any ethnic group, there's been massive starvation, slaughter, on levels we cannot comprehend. And here in America, I hurt my hand on a train. I think I'll sue for $20 million. My emotions are ruined. What kind of country can survive with this kind of weakness?
It's terrible. It's terrible. Of course, I know the story. I lived it. You know, General de Gaulle gave my father the highest French award after the Second World War for his activities in helping set up safe houses for escaped prisoners of French.
He must have been an extremely brave man, and your mother was obviously an extremely intuitive woman. How long did she live? I hope she escaped.
She told me that before she died, she told me that she had a dream or a premonition that if we would get circumcised, we would all be killed. The nice end of the story is that both my mother and father lived till 92 years, never a sick day in their life.
Isn't that something? So they didn't lay down and say, I've suffered so much, I can't go on. What do you think it was in them that enabled them to not only survive, but to fight? What do you think drove them?
Some of us, Michael, have optimism, living in the present, understanding what reality is and dealing with it and not complain, but just living day to day to survive and to be happy and live.
Well, on that note, to life, to life, to life, my friend, thank you. There's a lot of wisdom in what that man said. But as I say, we live in a nation of victims. Look at the election. All they're promising is Medicare, 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 prescriptions, 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 wheelchairs, crutches. It's like a nation of wimps and cripples. I don't mind helping a person who's sick, but why do you encourage people to be weak when you know a nation can't survive with a weak population? KNEW, San Francisco. Dane, welcome to the Savage Nation. On which topic do you call today?
You know, Mike, I wanted to talk about the derby thing of the horses. Your really insight on there is excellent. Something just doesn't smell right, because if you look at the picture in the paper, there's an incredible picture. Look at these two horses racing down this field. And I tell you, they got identical markings on their chest. And the first thing I thought when I looked at the Sunday's paper yesterday, here's the 1-2 horse, and the second one goes down. He keeps the purse, and now he's got the insurance. It's just something didn't smell right. So I think your insight there is incredible.
They euthanized her a little too quickly for me.
Way too quickly.
What kind of makes a decision like that in 1 second?
You're right. Something just doesn't smell right. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but something just didn't seem right.
Well, and they was very quick with the explanations, too, weren't they?
Yeah.
Immediately they had stories about she was family, and it's a very controversial story to begin with. But it's worth talking about on many different levels, and I thank you for calling. And I don't think I'm the first nor the last person to talk about this filly who was killed. This little girl, this horse ran her heart out, and she ran it because she wanted to please the trainer. She wanted to please the jockey. And there's a metaphor for life in it. That's why it's touched so many people who saw this event or have subsequently seen her lifting her head up as she's lying on the track with broken legs, as if to say, am I okay? Will I be okay? Did I do something to disappoint you? You know, I know animals. I can see it through a picture. She's asking if she did something to hurt them. And sure, they said, yeah, now we're going to kill you. You know, you want to see something eerie. Go look at that picture, I swear to you, on michaelsavage.com. You want to see something eerie? Take a look at that horse's face. See her lifting up her head as if to say, did I hurt you in some way? I know animals. They don't even know when they're hurt. They think that when they're hurt, they hurt you. Do you know that? I know a lot about animals. I don't want to go into it, but animals know me well. I visited someone's house today. I won't say who. It's unimportant who it was. But he was a very prominent individual, and it was a very highly tense meeting for me before going in there. And he has two dogs, and I knew about them, two little beautiful dogs. And I sat there, and someone had told me he had nice dogs. And in a few minutes, I said, by the way, where are your dogs? I'd like to see them. I'm a dog fancier. He said, they're out for a walk. He said, well, when they come in, they'll start barking at you. They'll run around and they'll bark a lot. Well, about 20 minutes later, the walker brought the dogs in. They both came next to me and lay down under my chair without so much as a bark. And so I'll tell you right now, animals know me and they know that I mean no harm. And I can read animals and animals can read me. Certainly not every animal. I can't read a gecko. I can't read a lizard. I can't read a Democrat, but I can read most animals. Grand Rapids, Michigan. Bridget, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, good evening. I am a true animal lover, and I've just got to say something about this 8 Bell situation. I did watch the Derby on TV, but you know what's interesting, Michael, is Barbaro, I believe he was the Kentucky Derby winner from, be it last year, mm-hmm. he had some sort of injuries, and they did everything they could to preserve him, to bring him back, to do what they could, invest time and money. A friend of mine who goes to the Derby a lot says, yeah, they do that because they're hoping to capitalize on the stud fees and all the children that they hope this horse will later breed.
Yes.
But I'm just saying to myself, my goodness.
Oh, my God, because she was a female, she couldn't put out the stud.
This is sexism by humans upon animals.
Oh, my God, it's an element I didn't even think of. She wasn't worth keeping. She couldn't even produce offspring.
I'm saying to myself, this is tinges of Terry Schiavo. Oh, the family loves her. We want only, you know, Michael Schiavo said, we want only what's best for her. Ah, so it involves her being starved and dehydrated to death. It's all for the good. Bull.
Wow. I didn't see that, Bridget. Thanks for enlightening me on that one. Did you hear that call? I'll be right back.
Galloped all the way out around the turn and was slowing down just as she was coming into the backstretch, and right next to the outrider, both front ankles just collapsed. She had fracture dislocations in both front. One of them penetrated the skin, but with fractures in both front, that unstable fracture, there wasn't even any possibility to splinter, so obviously she was euthanized immediately.
How unusual is that to occur?
Unheard of. I've never seen it or heard of it happening in that scenario. It's not particularly unusual for a horse to get some sort of lameness in both front, but for her to collapse and fracture both front legs at the same time is unbelievable.
Well, also euthanizing her within a few minutes is kind of unbelievable, but we've talked about why we as laymen think that there's money involved here. One, because insurance will not pay for the rehabilitation injury of an animal in general. I believe they'll only pay for a catastrophic event which causes the animal to be euthanized. And two, as a woman caller just mentioned from Las Vegas, it was not a stud horse, and the horse couldn't be used limping around for stud. The horse was a lady horse, a female horse, a filly, which also is unusual, running against these giant males. She ran her heart out. They ran a horse out of her league, and she ran to please the people who owned the train that ran her. And you look, I got to say, some pictures are worth 1,000 words. Go look at the picture I pulled off AP on michaelsavage.com of the horse looking up seconds or moments before they killed her. As she's laying on the track, she looks up, her noble, beautiful head, and she's saying with her face, "Did I hurt you? Did I do something wrong? What have I done to displease you?" And then they killed her. I'm sorry. This is one man's opinion. Maybe you disagree with me, and I'm sure you do. But that's why we have a democracy. We can disagree, you know. Kansas City, Pamela, welcome to the Savage Nation.
They're racing the horses too young, Michael, and training them too young.
Well, that's why I agree with PETA. I don't care what the name of the organization is. They say they shouldn't use horses until they're 3 years old, at least 3 years old. I had a caller who said even that's too young, that their legs aren't strong enough yet.
Correct.
You know what it is? It's like factory farming here. They want to squeeze as much money out of the animal as fast as they can, and what they're doing here is killing the horses out of a mercenary greed. Thank you for the call. San Luis Obispo, great place. Joan, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Michael. You were right. It's an atrocity that has happened, and what's unfortunate about the sexism is that she still has ovaries, And I have seen miracles of people putting horses in slings and keeping them up off the ground. It's a very long, a prolonged therapy that they would go through, and I've seen it with my own eyes. My great-grandfather was forced to work for the cavalry, I don't know if that's the word, in the Tsarist regime back in the late 1800s, and it was funny that you said that on your program about...
he worked for the Tsarist cavalry, okay.
He did. If that was work, he was forced to work. And before he, after a couple of battles, he and my great-grandmother from Poland said, we're out of here, and they immigrated to Michigan. And I just wanted to say that horsemanship is that horse fever has been in my blood ever since. I guess it's been over 100 years, and I'm only 38. But I just wanted to say I agreed with you when that young filly looked up at them and said, and you were right, that what did I do wrong? I can attest many, many times about how my horses would be hurt, and they looked at me like, did I hurt you? And they have an affinity for human beings, and I just wanted to...
You see, I know these things. Now, how would you figure out a city boy like me who doesn't ride horses knows this? How? How do I know these things?
You know why? Because you have grace, and only through nature shall thy get grace, and you have grace, Michael, and you have changed my life for sure. And thank you.
It's a touching story, and a lot of people don't want to listen to this. It's too heartbreaking. But you're in a great place, San Luis Obispo, because my daughter went to a Cal Poly at San Luis Obispo, and I visited there many times, and I know it's a really fabulous school. And I also know that many of the young people who go to that school come from agricultural backgrounds, and I used to see the horses in the in that college and the other animals. So I guess you're in that area because you yourself are in some way in animal husbandry, are you?
I am going to get my master's there don't bite your tongue or anything education, and so I wanted.
I understand that it's a fabulous field. We need people who are not authoritarian statists, or shall I say Stalinist Bolsheviks, to be in the state educational system to try to save our children from this mediocre brainwashing. Thanks for the call. The phone number is useless at this point because we're just about flat out of time. But again, I don't want to, draw on your heartstrings. I'm not going to talk about this much, but I'm shocked that the other so-called media talkers haven't talked about this and don't even understand what they're seeing. I see things and I kind of get it right away. Please look at the picture on michaelsavage.com. The AP photographer is just wonderful. He captured a true tragedy, and that's the dying horse. Shall I say the injured horse looking up and saying, moments before these beasts killed her, did I do something to hurt you? What have I done to disappoint you? I'm sorry. And then they said, it's okay. And now we're going to kill you. Good night. Good night. Good night.
Savage.